Disc 9.
Otto Gessler makes a habit of only dealing from a position of strength. He can't be bullied, and the last thing he needs is more money. If you try this, you walk out of there empty-handed, if you walk out at all. Either way, I'll walk out. I wouldn't be so sure of that. I'll walk out because it's your responsibility to make sure nothing happens to me. We know where you live. We know where your children go to school. And we always know where to find you. Again, Peterson's arrogant smile flashed across his lips. I wouldn't think a man with your past would threaten another man's family. But I suppose desperate times call for desperate measures. Isn't that how the saying goes? Let's get this over with, shall we? I want to get out of this fucking place. Peterson turned and started up the hill toward the villa, Odette silently at his heels. Eli Levant laid a small hand on Gabriel's shoulder. Maybe he's right. Maybe you shouldn't go in. He'll get me out. Besides, at this point, Gessler gains nothing from kidding me. Like the man says, desperate times call for desperate measures. Let's go home. I don't want them to win, Eli. People like Otto Gessler always win. Besides, where the hell are you planning on getting the money to buy back the paintings from him? Shamron? I can't wait to see the look on the old man's face when you file your expense report for this one. I'm not getting the money from Shamron. I'm getting it from the man who stole the paintings in the first place. Augustus Rolf? Of course. Atonement, yes? Sometimes, Eli, forgiveness comes at a heavy price. It was midday before they left. Peterson seemed annoyed to find his Mercedes parked in the gravel forecourt next to the Volkswagen van they'd thrown him into after his kidnapping. He climbed into the front passenger seat and reluctantly allowed Odette to cuff his wrist to the armrest on the door. Gabriel got behind the wheel and gunned the engine a little too aggressively for Peterson's taste. Odette sprawled in the back seat, his feet on the tan leather and a Beretta on his lap. The Swiss border lay only 15 miles from the villa. Gabriel led the way in the Mercedes, followed by Eli Levant in the van. It was a quiet crossing. The wearied border guard waved them across after a cursory inspection of their passports. Gabriel had briefly removed Peterson's handcuffs, but a mile past the border, he pulled off the road and chained him to the door again. From there it was northwest to Davos, then up to Reichenau, then west into the heart of inner Switzerland. In the Grimsel Pass, it began to snow. Gabriel eased off the throttle so Levant could keep pace in his clunky Volkswagen van. Peterson grew more restless as they drove farther north. He gave Gabriel directions as though he were leading him to a buried body. When he asked for the handcuffs to be removed, Gabriel refused. "Your lovers?" Peterson asked. "Odette? He's cute, but I'm afraid he's not my type." "I meant Anna Rolf." "I know what you meant. I thought a touch of humor might help to diffuse the situation. Otherwise I might be tempted to strike you very hard in the face." "Of course you're lovers. Why else would you be involved in this affair? She's had many lovers. I'm certain you won't be the last. If you'd like to see her file, I'd be happy to show it to you. As a professional courtesy, of course." "Do you do anything for principle, Gerhardt, or do you do things only for money? For example, why do you work for the Council of Ritli? Do you do it only for the money, or do you do it because you believe in what they're doing?"
"Both."
"Oh, really? Which principle compels you to work for Otto Gessler?" "I work for Otto Gessler because I'm sick of watching my country being dragged through the mud by a bunch of damned foreigners over something that happened before I was born. Your country turned looted Nazi gold into hard currency. It turned the dental gold and wedding rings of the Jewish people into hard currency. Thousands of terrified Jews placed their life savings in your banks on the way to the death chambers of Auschwitz and Sobibor, and then those same banks kept the money instead of handing it over to their rightful heirs. What does this have to do with me? 60 years. This happened 60 years ago. Why can't we move on from this? Why must you turn my country into an international pariah over the actions of a few greedy bankers 6 decades ago?
Because you have to admit wrongdoing, and then you have to make amends.
Money? Yes, you want money. You criticize the Swiss for our supposed greed, but all you want from us is money, as if a few dollars will help right all the wrongs of the past.
It's not your money. It helped to turn this landlocked little amusement park of a country into one of the richest in the world, but it's not your money. In the heat of the argument, Gabriel had been driving too fast, and Levon had fallen several hundred yards behind. Gabriel slowed down so Levon could close the gap. He was angry with himself. The last thing he wanted now was to debate the morality of Swiss history with Gerhard Petersen.
There's one more thing I need to know before we talk to Gessler.
You want to know how I knew about your connection to the Hamidi assassination?
Yes. A few years ago, 8 or 9, I can't remember exactly, a Palestinian with a questionable past wished to acquire a residence visa that would allow him to live temporarily in Geneva. In exchange for the visa and a guarantee from us that his presence in Switzerland would not be revealed to the State of Israel, this Palestinian offered to tell us the name of the Israeli who killed Hamidi.
What was the Palestinian's name? Gabriel asked, though he didn't need to wait for Peterson's answer. He knew. He supposed he'd known it all along.
His name was Tariq al-Hurani. He's the one who placed the bomb under your wife's car in Vienna. Yes, he's the one who destroyed your family.
5 miles from Otto Gessler's villa, at the edge of a dense pine forest, Gabriel pulled to the side of the road and got out. It was late afternoon, light fading fast, temperature somewhere around 20 degrees. A mountain peak loomed above them, wearing a beard of cloud. Which was it? The Eiger, the Jungfrau, the Mönch? He didn't really care. He simply wanted to get this over with, and get out of this country, and never set foot in it again. As he stalked around the car through 6 inches of wet snow, an image appeared in his mind. Tariq, telling Petersen about the bombing in Vienna. It was all he could do not to pull Petersen from the car and beat him senseless. At that moment, he wasn't sure who he hated more, Tariq or Petersen. Gabriel unlocked the handcuffs and made Petersen crawl over the shifter to get behind the wheel. Odette got out and joined Eli Levon in the van. Gabriel took Peterson's spot in the front passenger seat and, with a jab of the Beretta to the ribs, spurred him into motion. Darkness descended over the valley. Petersen drove with both hands on the wheel, and Gabriel kept the Beretta in plain sight. 2 miles from Gessler's villa, Levon slowed and pulled to the side of the road. Gabriel twisted round and looked through the rear window as the headlights died. They were alone now.
"Tell me one more time," Gabriel said, breaking the silence.
"We've gone over this 12 times.
Petersen objected.
"I don't care. I want to hear you say it one more time."
"Your name is Herr Meyer.
What do I do?"
"You work with me in the Division of Analysis and Protection."
"Why are you bringing me to the villa?"
"Because you have important information about the activities of the meddlesome Jew named Gabriel Allon. I wanted Herr Gessler to hear this news directly from the source."
"And what am I going to do if you deviate from the script in any way?"
"I'm not going to say it again."
"Say it. Fuck you."
Gabriel wagged the Beretta at him before slipping it into the waistband of his trousers.
"I'll put a bullet in your brain. And the guards. That's what I'll do."
"I'm sure you will," Petersen said. "It's the one thing I know you're good at."
A mile farther on was an unmarked private road. Petersen downshifted and took the turn expertly at considerable speed, the centrifugal force pressing Gabriel against the door. For an instant he feared Petersen was up to something, But then they slowed and glided along the narrow road, trees sweeping past Gabriel's window. At the end of the road was a gate of iron and stone that looked as though it could withstand an assault by an armored personnel carrier. As they approached, a security man stepped into the lights and waved his arms for them to stop. He wore a bulky blue coat that failed to conceal the fact that he was well armed. There was snow in his cap. Peterson lowered his window.
"My name is Gerhard Peterson. I'm here to see Herr Gessler. I'm afraid it's an emergency."
"Gerhard Peterson?"
"Yes, that's right."
"And who is that man?"
"He's a colleague of mine. His name is Herr Meyer. I can vouch for him."
The guard murmured a few inaudible words into the mouthpiece. A moment later the gate opened, and he stepped out of their path and waved them through. Peterson drove at a jogging pace. Gabriel looked out his window. Arc lights in the trees. Another blue-coated guard, this one being yanked through the forest by an Alsatian on a lead.
"My God," he thought, "the place looks like the Führer bunker. Add some razor wire and a minefield, and the picture would be complete."
Ahead of them, the trees broke, and the lights of the villa appeared, softened by a bridal veil of the drifting snow. Another guard stepped into their path. This one made no attempt to hide the compact submachine gun hanging from his shoulder. Once again, Peterson lowered the window, and the guard put his big face inside the car.
"Good evening, Herr Peterson. Herr Gessler is making his way to the pool house now. He'll see you there."
"Fine.
Are you armed, Herr Peterson?"
Peterson shook his head. The guard looked at Gabriel.
"And what about you, Herr Meyer? Are you carrying a gun this evening?"
"Nine.
Come with me."
A string of tiny lamps mounted on posts, no higher than a man's knee, marked the course of the footpath. The snow was deeper here than on the valley floor. A foot or more had fallen, and every fourth lamp or so was buried beneath a tiny drift. Peterson walked at Gabriel's side. The guard who had met them at the top of the drive now led the way. At some point another had come up behind them. Gabriel could feel the warm breath of an Alsatian on the back of his knee. When the dog nuzzled his hand, the guard jerked the lead. The animal growled in response, a low, deep-throated growl that made the air around it vibrate.
"Nice dog," thought Gabriel. "Let's not do anything to upset the fucking dog."
The pool house appeared before them, long and low, ornate globe lamps glowing through the rising mist. There were guards inside. Gabriel could just make them out through the fogged windows. One of them appeared to be leading a tiny, robed figure. And then Gabriel felt a searing pain in his right kidney. His back arched, his face tilted upward, and for an instant he saw the stiletto tips of the pine trees stretching toward the heavens, and in his agony the heavens were a Van Gogh riot of color and motion and light. Then the second blow fell, this one at the back of his head. The heavens turned to black, and he collapsed face down in the snow. Chapter 44. Nidwalden, Switzerland. Gabriel opened one eye, then slowly the other. He might as well have kept them closed, because the darkness was perfect. Absolute black, he thought, theoretical black. It was bitterly cold, the floor rough concrete, the air heavy with sulfur and damp. His hands were cuffed behind him with his palms pointed out, so that the muscles of his shoulders burned with lactic acid. He tried to imagine the contorted position of his body and limbs, right cheek and right shoulder pressed against the concrete, left shoulder in the air, pelvis twisted, legs knotted. He thought of art school, the way the teachers used to twist the limbs of the models to expose muscle and sinew and form. Perhaps he was just a model for some Swiss expressionist painting, man in a torture chamber, artist unknown. He closed his eyes and tried to right himself, but the slightest contraction of his back muscles set his right kidney on fire. Grunting, he fought through the pain and managed to set himself upright. He leaned his head against the wall and winced. The second blow had left a knot the size of an egg at the back of his head. He dragged his fingertips over the wall. Bare rock. Granite, he supposed. wet and slick with moss. A cave? A grotto of some sort? Or just another vault? The Swiss and their damned vaults. He wondered if they would leave him here forever, like a gold bar or a Burgundian armchair. The silence, like the darkness, was complete. Nothing from above or below, no voices, no barking dogs, no wind or weather, just a silence which sang in his ear like a tuning fork. He wondered how Peterson had done it. How had he signaled the guard that Gabriel was an intruder? A code word at the gate? A missing password? And what of Odette and Eli Lavon? Were they still sitting in the front seat of the Volkswagen van, or were they in the same position as Gabriel, or worse? He thought of Lavon's warning in the garden of the villa in Italy. People like Otto Gessler always win. Somewhere, the seal of a tightly closed door was broken, and Gabriel could hear footsteps of several people. A pair of flashlights burst on, and the beams played about until they found his face. Gabriel squeezed his eyes shut and tried to turn his head from the light, but the twisting of his neck caused his head wound to pound. "Put him on his feet." Peterson's voice, firm, authoritative. Peterson in his element. Two pairs of hands grabbed his arms and pulled. The pain was intense. Gabriel feared his shoulder joints were about to pop out of their sockets. Peterson drew back his fist and buried it in Gabriel's abdomen. His knees buckled, and he doubled over. Then Peterson's knee rose into his face. The guards released him, and he collapsed into the same contorted position in which he'd awakened. Man in a Torture Chamber by Otto Gessler. They worked as a team, one to hold him, the other to hit him. They worked efficiently and steadily, but without joy and without enthusiasm. They had been given a job, to leave every muscle in his body bruised and every spot on his face bleeding. And they carried out their assignment in a thoroughly professional and bureaucratic manner. Every few minutes they would leave to smoke. Gabriel knew this because he could smell the fresh tobacco on them when they came back. He tried to hate them, these blue-coated warriors for the bank of Gessler, but could not. It was Peterson whom he hated. After an hour or so, Peterson returned. "Where are the paintings you took from Rolf's safe deposit box in Zurich?" "What paintings?" "Where is Anna Rolf?" "Who?" "Hit him some more. See if that helps his memory." And on it went. For how long, Gabriel did not know. He didn't know whether it was night or day, whether he had been here an hour or a week. He kept time by the rhythm of their punches and the clock-like regularity of Peterson's appearances. "Where are the paintings you took from Rolf's safe deposit box in Zurich?"
"What paintings?"
"Where is Anna Rolf?"
"Who?"
"All right, see if he can handle a little more. Don't kill him." Another beating. It seemed shorter in duration, though Gabriel could not be sure, because he was in and out of consciousness. "Where are the paintings?"
"What
paintings?"
"Where is Anna Rolf?"
"Who?"
"Keep going."
Another knife-like blow to his right kidney, another iron fist to his face, another boot to his groin.
"Where are the paintings?"
Silence.
"Where is Anna Rolf?"
Silence.
"He's done for now. Let him lie there."
He searched the rooms of his memory for a quiet place to rest. Behind too many doors he discovered blood and fire, and could find no peace. He held his son. He made love to his wife. The room where he found her nude body was their bedroom in Vienna, and the encounter he relived was their last. He wandered through paintings he had restored, through oil and pigment and deserts of bare canvas, until he arrived on a terrace above a sea of gold leaf and apricot, bathed in the Siena light of sunset and the liquid music of a violin. Two guards came in. Gabriel assumed it was time for another beating. Instead, they carefully unlocked the handcuffs and spent the next 10 minutes cleaning and bandaging his wounds. They worked with the tenderness of morticians dressing a dead man. Through swollen eyes, Gabriel watched the water in the basin turn pink, then crimson with his blood.
"Swallow these pills."
"Cyanide?"
"For the pain. You'll feel a little better. Trust us."
Gabriel did as he was told, swallowing the tablets with some difficulty. They allowed him to sit for a few minutes. Before long, the throbbing in his head and limbs began to subside. He knew it was not gone, only a short postponement. Ready to get on your feet?
That depends on where you're taking me.
Come on, let us help you. They each grasped him gingerly by an arm and lifted. Can you stand up? Can you walk? He put his right foot forward, but the deep contusions in his thigh muscles made his leg collapse. They managed to catch him before he could hit the floor again, and for some reason found great humor in this.
Take it slowly, little steps for a little man. Where are we going?
It's a surprise. It won't hurt, though. We promise. They led him through the door. Outside, a corridor stretched before him like a tunnel, long and white, with a marble floor and an arched ceiling. The air smelled of chlorine. They must have been close to Gessler's swimming pool. They started walking. For the first few yards, Gabriel needed every bit of their support, but gradually, as the drugs circulated through his body and he became used to being vertical, he was able to move at a laborious shuffle without aid, a patient taking a first post-operative stroll through a hospital ward. At the end of the corridor was a double door, and beyond the doorway a circular room, about 20 feet across, with a high-domed ceiling. Standing in the center of the room was a small, elderly man dressed in a white robe, his face concealed by a pair of very large sunglasses. He held out a spindly, purple-veined hand as Gabriel approached. Gabriel left it hovering there.
Hello, Mr. Allon. I'm so glad we could finally meet. I'm Otto Gessler. Come with me, please. There are a few things that I think you might enjoy seeing.
Behind him, another double doorway opened, slowly and silently, as though on well-oiled automatic hinges. As Gabriel started forward, Gessler reached out and laid his bony hand on Gabriel's forearm. It was then that Gabriel realized Otto Gessler was blind. Chapter 45. Nidwalden, Switzerland. Before them lay a cavernous statuary hall with an arched ceiling reminiscent of the Musée d'Orsay. The light streaming through the overhead glass was man-made. On each side of the hall were a dozen passageways, leading to rooms hung with countless paintings. There were no labels, but Gabriel's trained eye discerned that each had its own mission. 15th-century Italian, 17th-century Dutch and Flemish, 19th-century French. And on it went, gallery after gallery, a private museum filled with Europe's lost masters. The effect was overwhelming, though obviously not to Gessler. Gessler could see none of it.
I'm sorry about the treatment you had to endure at the hands of my men, but I'm afraid you have only yourself to blame. You were very foolish to come here.
He had a reedy voice, dry and thin as parchment. The hand on Gabriel's forearm was weightless, like a breath of warm air.
Now I know why you were so anxious to silence Augustus Wolf. How many do you have? To be honest, even I don't know any more.
They passed the door to another room, 15th-century Spanish. A blue-coated security man paced lazily back and forth like a museum guard.
And you can't see any of it?
No, I'm afraid I can't.
Why keep them?
I think of myself rather like an impotent man. Just because I am unable to lie with my wife does not mean that I am willing to give her body to others.
So you're married?
An admirable attempt, Mr. Allon, but in Switzerland the right to privacy is very sacred. You might say that I've taken it somewhat to the extreme, but it's how I've chosen to live my life.
Have you always been blind?
You ask too many questions.
I came to offer you a proposition for ending this affair, but I can see now that you would never agree to it. You are the Hermann Göring of the 21st century. Your greed knows no bounds.
Yes, but unlike Herr Göring, whom I knew well, I am not guilty of looting.
What would you call this?
I'm a collector. It's a very special collection, a very private one, but a collection, nonetheless.
I am not the only one who knows about this. Anna Rolf knows, and so does my service. You can kill me, but eventually someone is going to find out what you have buried up here.
Gessler laughed a dry, humorless laugh.
Mr. Allon, no one is ever going to find out what's in this room. We Swiss take our privacy rights very seriously. No one will ever be able to open these doors without my consent. But just to make certain of that fact, I've taken an additional step. Using a little-known loophole in Swiss law, I declared this entire property a private bank. These rooms are part of that bank, vaults, if you will. This property contained in them is therefore covered by the banking secrecy laws of Switzerland, and under no circumstances can I ever be forced to open them or reveal their contents.
And this pleases you?
Indeed,
he said without reservation.
Even if I was forced to open these rooms, I could be prosecuted for no wrongdoing. You see, each of these objects was acquired legally under Swiss law, and morally under the laws of God and nature. Even if someone could prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that the work in my collection had been stolen from their ancestor by the Germans, they would have to reimburse me at fair market value. Obviously, the cost of repatriation would be astonishing. You and your friends in Tel Aviv can screech as much as you like, but I will never be forced to open the steel doors that lead to these rooms.
You're a son of a bitch, Gessler.
Oh, now you resort to curses and foul language. You blame the Swiss for this situation, but we are not to blame. The Germans started the war. We had the good sense to stay on the sidelines, and for this you wish to punish us.
You didn't sit on the sidelines. You collaborated with Adolf Hitler. You gave him guns, and you gave him money. You were his servants. You're all just servants.
Yes, we did reap a financial reward for our neutrality. But why do you raise this now? After the war, we settled with the Allies, and all was forgiven, because the West needed our money to help rebuild Europe. Then came the Cold War, and the West needed us again. Now the Cold War is over, and everyone from both sides of the Iron Curtain is beating down the Swiss door with their cap in hand. Everyone wants an apology. Everyone wants money. But someday you're going to need us again. It's always been that way. The German princes and the French kings, the Arab sheikhs and the American tax evaders, the drug lords and the arms merchants. My God, even your intelligence agency utilizes our services when it needs them. You yourself have been a frequent client of Credit Suisse over the years. So please, Mr. Allon, please climb down off your moral high horse for a moment and be reasonable.
You're a thief, Gessler. A common criminal.
A thief? No, Mr. Allon, I've stolen nothing. I've acquired, through smart business tactics, a magnificent private collection of art, along with staggering personal wealth. But I am not a thief. And what about you and your people? You bleat about the supposed crimes of the Swiss, but you founded your state on land stolen from others. Paintings, furniture, jewelry. These are just objects which are easily replaced. Land, however, is an entirely different matter. Land is forever. No, Mr. Allon, I'm not a thief. I'm a winner, just like you and your people.
Go to hell, Gessler.
I am a Calvinist, Mr. Allon. We Calvinists believe that wealth on earth is granted to those who will be admitted to the kingdom of heaven. If the Welt in these rooms is any clue, I will be going in the opposite direction of hell. The nature of your next life, I'm afraid, is somewhat less certain.
You can make your remaining time on Earth less unpleasant if you answer one simple question. Where are the paintings you removed from Augustus Wolff's safe deposit box?
What paintings?
Those paintings belong to me. I can produce a document that declares Rolf turned them over to me shortly before his death. I am the rightful owner of those paintings, and I want them back.
May I see the document, please?
Where are those paintings?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Gessler released Gabriel's arm.
Someone take him, please.
Chapter 46. Nidwalden, Switzerland. The drugs wore off, as Gabriel knew they would, and the pain returned stronger than before, as if it had used the respite to gather itself for a final assault. Every nerve in his body seemed to be transmitting charges of pain simultaneously. It overwhelmed his brain and he began to shiver, a violent, uncontrollable shiver that made his body hurt even more. He needed to be sick, but prayed he wouldn't. He knew the contraction of vomiting would inflict a new round of exquisite suffering. Once again he searched for a safe place for his thoughts to alight, but now the memory of Otto Gessler and his collection kept intruding. Gessler in his robe and sunglasses, room after room filled with pillaged Nazi art. He wondered whether it had really been true, or just a side effect of the drugs they had made him take. No, he thought. It is true. It was all there, gathered in one place, just beyond his reach, just beyond the world's reach. The door opened, and his body tensed. Who was it? Gessler's henchmen, come to kill him? Gessler himself, come to show him another room filled with lost masters? But as his chamber filled with light, he realized it was neither Gessler or his thugs. It was Gerhard Peterson. Can you stand up? No. Peterson crouched before him. He lit a cigarette, took a long time looking at Gabriel's face. He seemed saddened by what he saw there. It's important that you try to stand up. Why? Because they're coming to kill you soon. What are they waiting for? Darkness. Why do they need darkness? They're going to take your body up to the glacier field and drop it down a crevasse. That's comforting. I thought they'd just stuff me into a strongbox and deposit me in one of Gessler's numbered accounts. They considered that. A mirthless chuckle. I told you not to come here. You can't beat him. I told you. You should have listened to me. You're always right, Gerhard. You are right about everything. No, not everything. He reached into his coat pocket and produced Gabriel's Beretta. He placed it in the palm of his hand and held it toward Gabriel, like offertory. What's that for? Take it. He wagged the gun a little. Go on, take it. Why? Because you're going to need it. Without it, you have absolutely no chance of getting out of this place alive. With it, given your condition, I rate your chances at only 1 in 3. Worth a try, though, don't you agree? Take the gun, Gabriel. The gun was warm from Peterson's hand. The walnut grip, the trigger, the barrel. It was the first comforting object he had touched since he'd come to this place. I'm sorry you were beaten. It wasn't my choice. Sometimes an agent in place must do regrettable things to prove his bona fides to the people he's deceiving. If memory serves, the first 2 blows were yours. I've never struck another man before. It probably hurt me more than it hurt you. Besides, I needed time. Time for what? To make the arrangements to get you out of here. Gabriel released the magazine into his palm and made certain the gun was loaded, and not just another of Peterson's deceptions. I understand Gessler has quite a collection, said Peterson. You've never seen it? No, I've never been invited. Is it true? Is this place really a bank? No one can ever get inside. Gabriel, this entire country is a bank. Again Peterson reached into his pocket, and this time he produced a 6 tablets. Here, take these.
Something for the pain and a stimulant. You're going to need it. Gabriel swallowed the pills in one gulp, then rammed the magazine into the butt.
What kind of arrangements have you made?
I found your two friends. They were holed up in a guest house in the village. They'll be waiting at the bottom of the mountain at the edge of Gessler's property, near the spot where we left them yesterday.
Yesterday? Had it only been one day?
It seemed more like a year, a lifetime.
There's a single guard outside this door. You'll have to take care of him first, quietly. Can you manage that? Are you strong enough?
I'll be fine. Follow the corridor to the right. At the end you'll find a flight of stairs, and at the top of the stairs a doorway. That will put you outside, on the grounds. From there you just have to make your way down the slope of the mountain to your friends.
Through the guards and the Alsatians, thought Gabriel. Leave Switzerland the way we came in yesterday. I'll make sure the crossing is clear.
What will happen to you?
I'll tell them that I came to see you one last time to try to convince you to tell me where the paintings were hidden. I'll tell them that you overpowered me and escaped.
Will they believe you?
They might. Or then again they may drop me into that crevasse that they'd reserved for you.
Come with me.
My wife. My children.
Then he added, my country.
Why are you doing this? Why not let them kill me and be done with it?
And then Peterson told him the story of what had happened in his village during the war, the story of the Jews who had crossed into Switzerland from France in search of refuge, only to be expelled across the border into the arms of the Gestapo.
After my father's death, I was going through some of the papers in his study, trying to put his affairs in order. I found a letter. It was from the federal police, a commendation. Do you know what the commendation was for? It was my father who had reported the presence of the Jews in our village. It was because of my father that they were sent back to the Germans and murdered. I don't want any more Jewish blood on the hands of this family. I want you to leave this place alive.
When the storm hits, it might be unpleasant for you.
Storms have a way of punching themselves out against the mountain ranges of this country. They say that up on the Jungfrau, the wind blows 200 miles per hour. But the storms never seem to have much strength left when they reach Bern and Zurich. Here, let me help you up.
Peterson pulled him to his feet.
1 in 3? If you're lucky.
Gabriel stood just inside the door. Peterson beat his fist on it, twice. A moment later the bolts slid away, the door opened, and the guard entered the room. Gabriel stepped in front of him, and, using every last bit of strength he could summon, rammed the barrel of the Beretta through the guard's left temple. Peterson felt the neck for a pulse.
Very impressive, Gabriel. Take his coat.
It has blood on it.
Do as I say. It will make them hesitate before shooting you, and you'll need it for protection against the cold. Take his submachine gun, too, just in case you need something more powerful than your Beretta.
Peterson helped Gabriel remove the dead man's jacket. He wiped the excess blood onto the floor and pulled it on. He hung the machine gun over his shoulder. The Beretta he kept in his right hand.
Now me, said Peterson, something convincing but not quite as irrevocable.
Before Peterson could brace himself for the pain, Gabriel struck him with the butt of the Beretta high on the cheekbone, splitting flesh. Peterson momentarily lost his balance but stayed upright. He touched the wound with his fingertips, then looked at the blood.
The blood of atonement, yes?
Something like that.
Go.
Chapter 47. Nidwalden, Switzerland. The cold that greeted Gabriel as he stepped through the doorway at the top of the stairs was like another blow to the face. It was late afternoon, nightfall fast approaching, wind singing in the pines. His hands began to burn with the cold. He should have taken the dead man's gloves. He looked up and picked out the peak of the Jungfrau. A few brushstrokes of pale pink light lay high on its face, but the rest of the massif was blue and grey and entirely forbidding. They say that up on the Jungfrau the wind blows 200 miles per hour. The doorway was concrete and steel, like the entrance to a secret military bunker. Gabriel wondered how many were scattered around Gessler's estate, and what other wonders could be discovered by someone with access to them. He pushed those thoughts from his mind for now, and concentrated on orienting himself. He was not 50 yards from the pool house on the back side, a few yards from the trees.
Make your way down the slope of the mountain.
He walked across the open ground, through knee-deep snow, and entered the trees. Somewhere, a dog began to bark. The hounds of Gessler. He wondered how long it would be before another guard came to the cell and discovered the body, and how long Peterson could keep up the ruse that he'd been assaulted by a man who'd been beaten half to death. It was dark in the trees, and as he groped his way forward, he thought of the night he'd crept through Rolf's villa in Zurich, and discovered the photographs hidden in the false desk drawer.
Herr Hitler, I'd like you to meet Herr Rolf. Herr Rolf has agreed to do a few favors for us. Herr Rolf is a collector, like you, mein Führer.
There was one advantage to the cold. After a few moments he could no longer feel his face. Here the snow was a few inches less deep, but each step was a new adventure, an outcropping of rock, a fallen tree limb, a hole left by some burrowing animal. 4 times he lost his balance and fell, and each time it was harder to get up than the last. But he did get up, and he kept walking, down the fall line of the slope, down to the spot where Oded and Eli waited. Gabriel came upon a small clearing where a guard stood watch. The guard was 20 yards away, his back slightly turned, so that Gabriel saw him in semi-profile. He didn't trust himself to make the shot from that distance, not with his concussions and his swollen eyes and frozen hands, so he kept moving forward, hoping the dark would conceal his ragged appearance just long enough. He managed a few steps before one of his footfalls snapped a tree limb. The guard pivoted and looked at Gabriel, uncertain what to do next. Gabriel kept moving forward, calmly and steadily, as though he were the next shift coming on duty. When he was 3 feet away, he pulled the Beretta from his pocket and pointed it at the guard's chest. The round exited the man's back in a cloud of blood and tissue and polyester gossamer. The gunshot echoed up the mountainside. Immediately a dog began to bark, then another, then a third. Lights came on up at the villa. Beyond the clearing was a narrow track, just wide enough for a small vehicle. Gabriel tried to run, but could not. His muscles had neither the strength nor the coordination required to run down the slope of a snow-covered mountain. So he walked, and barely managed that. Ahead of him, he sensed that the contour of the land was beginning to flatten out, as if Gessler's mountain was meeting the valley floor. And then he saw the lights of the Volkswagen and 2 figures, mere shadows, Levant and Oded, stomping their feet against the cold.
Keep moving. Walk.
From behind he heard a dog bark, followed by the voice of a man.
Halt, you! Halt before I shoot!
Judging from the volume, they were very close, 30 yards, no more. He looked down the mountain. Oded and Levant had heard it too, because they were now scrambling up the road to meet him. Gabriel kept walking.
Halt, I say! Halt now or I'll shoot!
He heard a rumble and turned around in time to see the Alsatian, released from the restraint of its lead, charging toward him like an avalanche. Behind the dog was the guard, a submachine gun in his hands. Gabriel hesitated a fraction of a second. Who first, dog or man? Man had a gun, dog had jaws that could break his back. As the dog leapt through the air toward him, he raised the Beretta one-handed and fired past the beast toward his master. The shot struck him in the center of his chest and he collapsed onto the track. Then the dog drove his head into Gabriel's chest and knocked him to the ground. As he hit the frozen track, his right hand slammed to the ground and the Beretta fell from his grasp. The dog went immediately for Gabriel's throat. He raised his left arm over his face, and it took that instead. Gabriel screamed as the teeth tore through the protective layer of the jacket and embedded themselves in the flesh of his forearm. The dog was snarling, thrashing his giant head about, trying to move his arm away so it could be rewarded with the soft flesh of his throat. Frantically, he beat the snowy ground with his right hand, searching for the lost Beretta. The dog bit down harder, breaking bone. Gabriel screamed in agony. The pain was more intense than anything Gessler's thugs had inflicted on him. One last time, he swept the ground with his hand. This time he found the grip of the Beretta. With a vicious twist of its massive neck, the dog forced Gabriel's arm to the side and lunged for his throat. Gabriel pressed the barrel of the gun against the dog's ribs and fired three shots into its heart. Gabriel pushed the dog away and got to his feet. There were shouts coming from the direction of the villa, and Gessler's dogs were baying. He started walking. The left sleeve of his jacket was in tatters, and blood was streaming over his hand. After a moment he saw Eli Levon running up the track to him, and he collapsed in his arms.
"Keep walking, Gabriel. Can you walk?"
"I can walk."
"Oded, get a hold of him. My God, what have they done to you, Gabriel? What have they done?"
"I can walk, Eli. Let me walk."
Part 4. 3 months later. Chapter 48. Port Navis, Cornwall. The cottage stood above a narrow tidal creek, low and stout and solid as a ship, with a fine double door and white shuttered windows. Gabriel returned on a Monday. The painting, a 14th-century Netherlandish altarpiece, care of Isherwood Fine Arts, St. James's, London, came on the Wednesday. It was entombed in a shipping crate of reinforced pine, and borne up the narrow staircase to Gabriel's studio by a pair of thick boys who smelled of their lunchtime beer. Gabriel chased away the smell by opening a window and a flask of pungent Arcosolve. He took his time uncrating the painting. Because of its age and fragile state, it had been shipped in not one crate but two, an inner crate that secured the painting structurally, and an outer crate that cradled it in a stable environment. Finally, he removed the cushion of foam padding and the shroud of protective silicone paper, and placed the piece on his easel. It was the centerpiece of a triptych, approximately 3 feet in height and 2 feet in width, oil on three adjoining oak panels with vertical grain, almost certainly Baltic oak, the preferred wood of the Flemish masters. He made diagnostic notes on a small pad: severe convex warp, separation of the second and third panels, extensive losses and scarring. And if it had been his body on the easel instead of the altarpiece? Fractured jaw, cracked right cheekbone, fractured left eye socket, chipped vertebrae, broken left radius caused by severe dog bite requiring prophylactic treatment of rabies shots, 100 sutures to repair more than 20 cuts and severe lacerations of the face, residual swelling and disfigurement. He wished he could do for his face what he was about to do for the painting. The doctors who had treated him in Tel Aviv had said only time could restore his natural appearance. 3 months had passed, and he still could barely summon the courage to look at his face in the mirror. Besides, he knew that time was not the most loyal friend of a 50-year-old face. For the next week and a half he did nothing but read. His personal collection contained several excellent volumes on Rogier, and Julian had been good enough to send along two splendid books of his own, both of which happened to be in German. He spread them across his work table and perched atop a tall, hard stool, his back hunched like a cyclist, his fists pressed to his temples. Occasionally he would lift his eyes and contemplate the piece mounted on his easel, or look up to watch the rain running in rivulets over the skylight. Then he would lower his gaze and resume his reading. He read Martin Davis and Lorne Campbell. He read Panofsky and Winkler and Hulin and Dijkstra. And of course he read the second volume of Friedlander's monstrous work on early Netherlandish painting. How could he restore a work even remotely linked to Roger without first consulting the learned Friedlander? As he worked, the newspaper clippings rattled off his fax machine. One a day, at least, sometimes two or three. At first it became known as the Rolf Affair, then, inevitably, Rolfgate. The first piece appeared in the New Zürcher Zeitung. Then the Bern and Lucerne papers got in on the act, and then Geneva. Before long, the story spread to France and Germany. The first English-language account appeared in London, followed 2 days later by another in a prominent American weekly. The facts were tenuous, the stories speculative. Good reading, but not exactly good journalism. There were suggestions that Rolf had kept a secret art collection, suggestions that he had been murdered for it. There were tentative links made to the secretive Swiss financier Otto Gessler, though Gessler's spokesman dismissed it all as malicious lies and gossip. When his lawyers began issuing not-so-subtle warnings about pending lawsuits, the stories quickly died. The Swiss left demanded a parliamentary inquiry and a full-fledged government investigation. For a time, it appeared as though Bern might be forced to dig deeper than the topsoil. Names would be named. Reputations would be ruined. But soon the scandal blew itself out. Whitewash, screamed the Swiss left. Shame on Switzerland, cried the Jewish organizations. Another scandal swept into the sewers of the Bahnhofstrasse. The Alps had absorbed the brunt of the storm. Bern and Zurich were spared. A short time later, there was an odd postscript to the story. The body of Gerhard Petersen, a high-ranking federal security officer, was found in a crevasse in the Bernese Oberland, the victim of an apparent hiking mishap. But Gabriel, alone in his Cornish studio, knew Petersen's death was no accident. Gerhard Petersen was just another deposit in the bank of Gessler. Anna Rolf managed to remain aloof from the scandal swirling about her dead father. After her triumphant appearance in Venice, she embarked on an extensive European tour, consisting of solo recitals and appearances with major continental orchestras. The critics declared that her playing matched the fire and brilliance of her work before the accident, though some of the journalists moaned about her refusal to sit down for interviews. At the new question surrounding her father's death, she released a paper statement referring all questions to a lawyer in Zurich. The lawyer in Zurich steadfastly refused to discuss the matter, citing privacy and continuing inquiries, and on it went until interest in the story spun itself out. Gabriel lifted his head and peered through the skylight. He hadn't noticed until now, but the rain had finally stopped. He listened to the weather forecast on Radio Cornwall while he straightened up the studio. No rain until evening, periods of sun, reasonable temperatures for the Cornish coast in February. His arm was only recently healed, but he decided a few hours on the water would do him good. He pulled on a yellow oilskin coat, and in the kitchen he made sandwiches and filled the thermos flask with coffee. A few moments later, he was untying the ketch and guiding it under power, away from the quay, and down the Port Navis Creek to the Helford River. A steady wind blew from the northwest. Bright sunlight sparkled on the wavelets and the green hillsides rising above the Helford Passage. Gabriel locked down the wheel, pulled up the mainsail and the jib. Then he shut down the engine and allowed the boat to be taken by the wind. And soon it left him. He knew it was only temporary. It would last only until he closed his eyes, or allowed his mind to lie fallow for too long. But for now he was able to concentrate on the boat, rising and falling beneath him, and not the beatings he had suffered or the things he had seen. Some nights, as he lay alone in his beastly single bed, he wondered how he would be able to live with such knowledge, the knowledge that Otto Gessler had so cruelly given him. In his weaker moments he considered going before the world's press himself, telling his story, writing a book, but he knew that Gessler would just hide behind his banking secrecy laws. Gabriel would end up looking like yet another refugee of the secret world, peddling a half-baked conspiracy theory. As he neared August Rock, he looked toward the west and saw something he didn't like in the towering cloud formation. He slipped down the companionway and switched on his marine radio. A storm was approaching. Heavy rain, seas 6 to 8. He went back to the wheel, brought the boat about, then laid on the aft sail. The ketch immediately increased speed. By the time he reached the mouth of the Helford, it was raining heavily. Gabriel pulled up the hood of his oilskin and went to work on the sails, taking down the aft sail first, followed by the jib and the main sheet. He switched on the motor and guided the boat upriver. A squadron of gulls gathered overhead, begging for food. Gabriel tore his second sandwich to bits and tossed it onto the water. He passed the old oyster bed, rounded the point, and headed into the quiet of the tidal creek. The trees broke, and the roof of the cottage floated into view. As he drew nearer, he could see a figure standing on the quay, hands in pockets, collar up against the rain. Gabriel ducked down the companionway and grabbed a pair of Zeiss binoculars hanging from a hook next to the galley. He raised the glasses and focused them on the man's face, then quickly lowered them. He did not need to further authenticate the image. Ari Shamron sat down at the small table in the kitchen, while Gabriel made fresh coffee.
"You're actually starting to look like your old self again. You used to be a good liar. Eventually the swelling will go down. Do you remember Baruch, the terrible beating he took from the Hezbollah before we pulled him out? After a few months he almost looked like himself again."
"Baruch was ugly to begin with."
"This is true. You were beautiful once. Me, I could do with a beating. It might actually improve my looks."
"I'm sure I could find several eager volunteers."
Shamron's face set into an iron grimace. For a moment he seemed a little less like a weary old man, and more like the Sabra warrior who had pulled Gabriel from the womb of Bezalel School of Art 30 years earlier.
"They'd look worse than you when I was finished with them."
Gabriel sat down and poured coffee for them both.
"Did we manage to keep it all a secret?"
"There were some rumors at Kingshole Boulevard. Rumors about unexplained movement of personnel and strange expenses incurred in Venice and Zurich. Somehow these rumors reached the Prime Minister's office."
"Does he know?"
"He suspects. And he's pleased. He says that if it's true, he doesn't want to know."
"And the paintings?"
"We've been working quietly with a few art restitution agencies and the American Department of Justice. Of the 16 paintings you discovered in Rolf's safe deposit box, 9 have been returned to the heirs of their rightful owners, including the one that belonged to Julian's father."
"And the rest?"
"They'll reside in the Israel Museum, just as Rolf wished, until their owners can be located. If they can't be found, they'll hang there forever."
"How's Anna?"
"We still have a team with her. Rami is about to lose his mind. He says he'll do anything to get off her detail. He's ready to volunteer for patrol duty in Gaza."
"Any threats?"
"None yet."
"How long should we keep her under protection?"
"As long as you want. It was your operation. I leave that decision to you."
"At least a year."
"Agreed."
Shamron refilled his cup and lit one of his evil Turkish cigarettes.
"She's coming to England next week, you know. The Albert Hall. It's the last stop on her tour."
"I know, Ari. I can read the papers, too.
She asked me to give you this."
He slid a small envelope across the tabletop.
"It's a ticket to the performance. She asked that you come backstage after the show to say hello."
"I'm in the middle of a restoration right now."
"You or a painting?"
"A painting."
"Take a break."
"I can't take the time to go to London right now."
"The Prince of Wales is going to make time to attend, but you're too busy."
"Yes."
"I'll never understand why you insist on allowing beautiful, talented women to slip through your fingers."
"Who said I was going to do that?"
"You think she's going to wait forever?"
"No,
just until the swelling goes down."
Shamron gave a dismissive wave of his thick hand.
"You're using your face as a convenient excuse not to see her. But I know the real reason. Life is for the living, Gabriel. And this pleasant little prison you've made for yourself is no life. It's time for you to stop blaming yourself for what happened in Vienna. If you have to blame someone, blame me."
I'm not going to London looking like this.
If you won't go to London, will you permit me to make another suggestion?
Gabriel let out a long, exasperated breath. He had lost the will to resist him any longer.
I'm listening, he said.
Chapter 49. Corsica. That same afternoon, the Englishman invited Anton Orsatti up to his villa for lunch. It was gusty and cold, too cold to be outside on the terrace, so they ate at the kitchen table and discussed some mildly pressing matters concerning the company. Don Orsatti had just won a contract to supply oil to a chain of 24 bistros stretching from Nice to Normandy. Now an American import-export company wanted to introduce the oil to the specialty shops in the United States. Demand was beginning to outpace supply. Orsatti needed more land and more trees. But would the fruit stand up to his exacting standards? Would quality suffer with expansion? That was the question they debated throughout the meal. After lunch, they settled next to the fire in the living room and drank red wine from an earthen pitcher. It was then that the Englishman confessed that he had acted with dishonor during the Rolf affair. Orsatti poured himself some more of the wine and smiled.
When the Signora told me you came home from Venice without your talisman, I knew something out of the ordinary had taken place. What happened to it, by the way?
I gave it to Anna Rolf.
How?
The Englishman told him. Orsatti was impressed.
I'd say you won that confrontation on points. How did you get the blazer?
I borrowed it from a security guard at the Scuola.
What happened to him?
The Englishman looked into the fire.
Orsatti murmured, Poor devil.
I asked nicely once.
The question is, why?
Why did you betray me, Christopher? Haven't I been good to you?
The Englishman played the tape he'd taken from Emile Jacobi in Lyon. Then he gave Orsatti the dossier he had prepared, based on his own investigation, and went into the kitchen to clean up the dishes from lunch. The Corsican was a notoriously slow reader. When he returned, Orsatti was finishing the dossier. He closed the file and his dark gaze settled on the Englishman.
Professor Jacobi was a very good man, but we are paid to kill people. If we spent all our time wrestling with questions of right and wrong, no work would ever get done.
Is that the way your father conducted his business? And his father? And his?
Orsatti pointed his thick forefinger like a gun at the Englishman's face.
My family is none of your affair, Christopher. You work for me. Don't ever forget that.
It was the first time Orsatti had spoken to him in anger. I meant no disrespect, Don Orsatti. The Corsican lowered his finger.
None taken.
Do you know the story of the Signora and what happened to her husband?
You know much about the history of this place, but not everything. How do you think the Signora keeps a roof over her head? Do you think she survives on the money she makes chasing away evil spirits and her magic oil and holy water?
You take care of her?
Orsatti gave a slow nod.
She told me that sometimes a Tadunagyu can dispense justice as well as vengeance.
This is true. Don Tomasi certainly deserved to die.
I know a man who deserves to die.
The man in your dossier.
Yes.
It sounds as though he's very well protected. I'm better than any of them.
Orsatti held his glass up to the fire and watched the light dancing in the ruby-colored wine.
You're very good, but killing a man like that will not be easy. You'll need my help.
You?
Orsatti swallowed the last of his wine.
Who do you think climbed Don Tomasi's mountain and slit his evil throat?
Chapter 50. Costa da Prata, Portugal. Carlos, the vineyard keeper, was the first to see him arrive. He looked up from his work as the car pulled into the gravel drive, and watched as the art restorer named Gabriel was greeted by the one called Rami. They exchanged a few words. Rami touched the scars on the art restorer's face. This Carlos could see from his post at the base of the vineyard. He was not a military man, but Carlos recognized a changing of the guard when he saw one. Rami was leaving, and not soon enough. Rami had tired of Our Lady's antics, as Carlos knew he would. Our Lady needed a man of unending patience to watch over her. Our Lady needed the restorer. He watched as Gabriel crossed the drive and disappeared into the villa. Our Lady was upstairs in her room, practicing. Surely the restorer did not intend to interrupt her. For a moment, Carlos considered running up the terrace to intervene, but then he thought better of it. The restorer needed to learn a lesson, and some lessons are best learned the hard way. So he laid down his pruning shears and found the flask of Bacasso in his pocket. Then he crouched amid his vines and lit a cigarette, watching the sun diving toward the sea, waiting for the show to begin. The sound of her violin filled the villa as Gabriel climbed the stairs to her room. He entered without knocking. She played a few more notes, then stopped suddenly. Without turning around, she shouted, "God damn you, Rami! How many fucking times have I told you?" And then she turned and saw him. Her mouth fell open, and for an instant she released her grip on the Guarneri. Gabriel lunged forward and snatched it out of the air before it could hit the floor. Anna seized him in her arms.
"I never thought I'd see you again, Gabriel. What are you doing here?"
"I've been assigned to your security detail."
"Thank God!
Rami and I are going to kill each other."
"So I've heard. How many people on the new team?"
"I thought I'd leave that decision in your hands."
"I think one man would be enough, if that's all right with you."
"That would be fine," he said. "That would be perfect." Chapter 51. Nidwalden, Switzerland. Otto Gessler propelled himself through silken water, gliding forward in perpetual darkness. He had swum well that day, two lengths more than usual, 150 meters in all, quite an accomplishment for a man of his age. Blindness required him to carefully count each stroke, so that he did not crash headlong into the side of the pool. Not long ago he could devour each length with 22 powerful strokes. Now it required 40. He was nearing the end of the last length, 37, 38, 39. He stretched out his hand, expecting the glass-like smoothness of Italian marble. Instead, something seized his arm and lifted him out of the water. He hung there for a moment, helplessly, like a fish on a line, his abdomen exposed, his ribcage splayed. And then the knife plunged into his heart. He felt a searing pain. Then, for the briefest instant, he could see. It was a flash of brilliant white light somewhere in the distance. Then the hand released him, and back into his silken water he fell. Back into the perpetual darkness. This concludes the reading of The English Assassin by Daniel Silva. Copyright 2002 by Daniel Silva. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in 2002 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book was read by John Lee. Books on Tape produces many new audiobook titles each month. To find out more about them, call our customer service department at the number which appears on this package, or visit us at our website, www.booksontape.com.